Welcome, everyone, to the podcast series Ancient World New Voices, where each episode discusses a university research on an exciting aspect of the ancient world. Brought to you by Martina Gandapur, Giovanna Di Martino, Sofia Bongiovanni, and Melissa Pires da Silva. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing you to our guest, Maddalena Italia. Maddalena Italia is currently a research fellow at the Department of Greek and Latin at UCL. And she is working on the Level Hume-funded project called Comparative Classics, Greece, Rome, and India. Maddalena's more general research interests include Sanskrit literature, classical reception studies, comparative classics, but also translations and pseudo-translations, as well as world philology and world literature. Today, on our podcast, she is going to talk to us a bit more about Sanskrit erotic poetry. Hi, Maddalena, how are you?
Hello, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so much for agreeing to share a bit of your research with us. We are very excited to have you. Let's just start by explaining what it is that you're looking at specifically.
Yes, the Sanskrit erotic poetry. So, of course, you might be wondering, where did this start? Because it's not that you come across Sanskrit erotic poetry every day. Well, it depends. If you know where to look for it, probably you would. I have to say that when I started studying Sanskrit in Italy, in Milan, at Milan State University, I was first very much in love with the Sanskrit as a language. So I fell in love effectively with Sanskrit as a language. And of course, right from the get-go, I was looking at Sanskrit from a comparative perspective, though that was mainly, I would say, a linguistic comparative perspective. So the comparative angle was primarily from the point of view of language. So we're talking about vocabulary, but we're also talking about morphology and syntax. And then, of course, many of you will be familiar with the notion of the Proto-Indo-European reconstructed language and the idea that Sanskrit shares a common genealogy, a common ancestor with Greek and Latin, because at the time, and perhaps I should have said that earlier, I was a student of classics. So I started as a classicist, and I started studying Sanskrit because I was very much interested in the language. So my approach was that of a comparative philologist, but in the sense of a comparative linguist. So I was really interested in the shared linguistic features between Greek, Sanskrit, and Latin. So it all made perfect sense to me until I realized that there was more to Sanskrit than the mere study of linguistic similarities. And I fell in love with the literature as well. So, and in the department where I was studying, the professors and researchers had focused primarily on what is called classical Sanskrit poetry. That's how we call it. And that is also interesting that we call it classical Sanskrit poetry. And what we mean is a corpus of literature where the theme of love, or should I say Sringara, which is in itself almost an untranslatable term that embraces the idea of passion, sensuality, attraction, desire, but also love as a feeling, as a sentiment. And also this concept has a whole dimension in the aesthetic theory of Sanskrit literature. So how you express, almost recreate this feeling in literature, and how it is experienced by the listener or the spectator, if it is theater, or the reader of poetry. So I was extremely intrigued by this theme, the expression and literary recreation of this feeling. And I realized that Sringara was everywhere. It was everywhere in the kind of literature that I was exposed to. And then I realized that there were some collections of erotic verses in Sanskrit written between, well, the ones I focused on written between, I would say, the 5th century CE and the early 12th century CE again. Collections of verses that are freestanding verses, so they can be read in isolation. And these verses had a surprisingly long afterlife in the West. So starting from the beginning, well, the more precisely second or third decade of the 19th century. So they had started being translated and much loved by Western audiences. They enjoyed their own steady, uninterrupted popularity. You might argue that they enjoyed a kind of niche popularity, of course, compared to other literary works written in Sanskrit. I'm thinking in particular of more philosophical and religious works written in Sanskrit. But still, the fame, the popularity of these collections of erotic verses written in Sanskrit, this popularity never faded, and they were retranslated into different modern but also classical European languages, if we include Latin, so 19th century Latin, of course. And that opened up for me an entirely new world, something that I hadn't initially envisaged. And from that point, really, I moved on to develop an interest really in the reception mainly in Europe and in North America of these collections of Sanskrit erotic poetry from the first decades of the 19th century until, I would say, that my end point, at least for the book project I'm working on, I would say that the end point is the end of the third decade of the 20th century.
Amazing. That was a very nice overview, actually, of the entire research project. So thank you. That is very helpful. I actually am very intrigued by this linguistic sensibility that you also have from your previous classicist background. And I'm wondering how your methodology works in your current research, if perhaps that linguistic background also helps you approach the literature, this Sanskrit erotic poetry, in a specific way, perhaps.
I would say that, interestingly, my background as a classicist and as a, let's say, a comparative philologist in the sense of a comparative linguist informed the way in which I read the approach and the commentaries written by 19th century and early 20th century philologists, but also in general literati and poets, when they look at Sanskrit erotic poetry, because I can somehow empathize, even sympathize with certain even problematic ways of looking at and interpreting and making sense of Sanskrit erotic poetry. Because the truth is that these philologists and these, let's use even the term, again, the problematic term of Orientalists, who were reading and translating and commenting upon the Sanskrit text, were primarily classicists. So when they looked at Sanskrit erotic poetry, the first thing they thought was, okay, how does this compare with the Greek and Latin erotic poetry? And that this particular lens, this comparative classicist lens, is on the one hand an advantage from a certain angle, because of course it's always useful to look at different literary traditions in a comparative fashion. But on the other hand, it is a limit. It is a very serious limit. And it's risky. It's incredibly risky because, yeah, the risk is that you end up reading classical Sanskrit poetry, and in particular erotic poetry, as if it were just part of the same intertext into which Greco-Roman materials are also situated. And of course, that can create some very deep misunderstandings, or even, you know, we talk a lot about the phenomenon of appropriation, how you coming from an external and also unfamiliar perspective, you appropriate a foreign literary tradition, you make it your own, but not only do you make it your own, you also shape it in a way that it ends up resembling your starting point. So you make everything that is foreign and alien to an extent into something that really looks like you. Yes, so again, my answer is that it was not so much the strictly linguistic perspective that helped me, but rather this broadly and loosely intended perspective of a comparative classicist that allowed me to put myself in the shoes of these 19th century and early 20th century philologists and Orientalists, to use this term, and to an extent understand where they were coming from, but at the same time criticize what they were doing, while at the same time being aware of the fact that I was part, in a way, of the same tradition of reading Sanskrit literature in a certain problematic way.
Yes, thank you so much for outlining this really amazing self-aware methodology, which I think is very important to question the way we are approaching certain texts and if we are not, in some senses, perhaps biased when we approach texts, even if we don't try to be, like you say. So this is a really important point, and you've really explained it well. Thank you so much. I'm also thinking about how important it is to say that Sanskrit erotic poetry is therefore a very self-standing area of research, like you put it. So I'm wondering, are there perhaps some key characteristics that you find have come out of your research that really characterize Sanskrit erotic poetry specifically?
Yes, so I would say that from the point of view, again, because I'm looking at the reception of these texts, what really stood out also in the perspective of the first readers and translators of Sanskrit erotic poetry was the way in which sexuality, and I would say in particular, female sexuality was represented. And this was to an extent unusual. This was not fully comparable and compatible with what they were used to, these Orientalists, and also the general public really were used to when looking at instead at Greco-Roman materials. And I think that these representations of sexuality had really a polarizing effect, because on the one hand, you had a reaction of, how can I put it, of rejection. So you had Orientalists who would say that this kind of poetry was unpalatable, it was immoral, and hence not comparable with the much more moral poetry of the West. The West intended as a monolith.
Yes.
Yeah, which of course is something we can very easily criticize. But also you had readers and translators who would instead find in Sanskrit erotic poetry a whole dimension that was liberating, because these readers and critics would say, well, we appreciate and we enjoy the fact that in this poetry there is a much more natural representation, a much more genuine and truthful representation of desire, of sexuality and sensuality, sensuousness, something that some critics would even say, well, this particular attitude towards sexuality is characteristic not only of the Indians, again, very problematic, and say the Italians. So here I'm thinking in particular of one Italian philologist and translator, Giuseppe De Lorenzo, who would say, well, we Italians can really, again, the image of the mirror image of one's own self, we can see ourselves in this pre-modern Indian poetry, because we Italians, in fact, have the same very healthy attitude towards sexuality. And this puts us in this privileged position with, these pre-modern Indian writers, and allows us to distinguish ourselves from all the other European nations, because they instead do not understand, they do not share in this very natural attitude to sexuality. So you see how interesting this is, because
yes.
the yes. same feature can be seen from different angles. So
I can really tell that also the reception aspect that you mentioned really helps extract the different layers that are in Sanskrit erotic poetry, depending on who receives those poems, right? So the reception aspect really helps us extract something from Sanskrit erotic poetry, which is very helpful.
Indeed. I mean, this is an excellent summary. I should really quote you in my introduction when the book comes out. That's amazing. But yes, indeed. And that also reminds us of the fact that just as we should never essentialize and generalize the poetry of a specific period and written in a specific language, at the same time, we should never generalize, you know, these essentializing tropes when talking about the reception of a certain literary tradition or a certain literary genre. Because again, when we talk about the reception of classical Sanskrit erotic poetry, there are so many voices, there are so many layers, and it's really a polyphonic symphony. It's not just a single reaction, it's much more nuanced. And I think that's the beauty of it, looking at all these nuances and how these different attitudes ultimately, I think, informed the way or the ways in which we now still look at this literary tradition.
Yes, absolutely. I also think that it would be important to mention at this point the book that you mentioned, that you're working on, because it probably consolidates also how important it is not to essentialize, as you say, or generalize poetry overall, but also this specific Sanskrit erotic poetry. Do these findings that you just shared with us about the importance of not essentializing Sanskrit erotic poetry, do they help you move towards a overarching main research goal in that book?
I think that I have several research questions. And one certainly has to do with the very notion of classics or classical literature. So how yes. a certain literary tradition becomes part of a canon, whether we describe that canon as the canon of the world's classics or world literature, here perhaps world poetry, or even, in the case of Sanskrit literature, whether this can be part of the classical canon intended in a more restrictive way as the Greco-Roman classics plus, so expanding the notion of ancient classical literatures. So,
yes.
I think that normally when we think of Sanskrit literature as a classical literature, we think of religious and philosophical works. We think perhaps of the Bhagavad Gita, we think of the Vedas. Perhaps we think of theater, we might think of Kalidasa's Shakuntala, because it had its own very rich, very intriguing, very dense history of reception, starting from, in fact, the end of the 18th century in Europe. Of course, here I'm always talking about the modern reception and always with a focus on the so-called West. But instead, what I want to really show is that there's more than that. And these poems have always circulated and have always informed the way in which even general audiences were thinking of Sanskrit literature as classic or classical. So for example, just to give you an example, so I was looking at a certain point in my research, I was looking at the first anthology of world poetry, at least the first anthology that had this title, which came out in 1928, if I'm not mistaken, the editor being Mark van Doren. And there is a quite robust Sanskrit section in this book. And so I wanted to see what was extracted and anthologized as a representative of this classical tradition or of this tradition of world poetry that was part of world poetry. And I realized that more than half of it was erotic poetry. And that was a great finding because it really helped me consolidate something that was already an assessment that I was reaching, that Sanskrit erotic poetry was really part, and in fact, it was a very substantial and important part of the classical Sanskrit literature that traveled, that was translated, that enjoyed many lives, many births and afterbirths, many avatars, I'm tempted to say, Sanskritically. And also another finding of my research was that not only do we have, for example, Latin, 19th century Latin translations of Sanskrit erotic poetry, so strictly scholarly and philological works on this kind of literature, but we had really a proliferation of second and even third hand translations of Sanskrit erotic literature that circulated in a kind of not entirely authorized way, because of course if you think of censorship, still these translations, which were considered to be morally dubious, but they still circulated, and again they were retranslated, which means that there was an audience for them, that there were people who were not Sanskritists, who knew nothing about Sanskrit as a sacred language, but who were nonetheless interested in reading those poems. And to conclude, my final point is that I also discovered that there is a very niche genre, or rather subgenre, of pseudo-translations, so of fake Sanskrit erotic poems that circulated in French, I would say first in French, and which were then retranslated into, or translated, because there was no original behind them, they were translated into English. And so, and it's so interesting to read these poems and to see what this modern Western poet thought would pass as Sanskrit erotic poetry, how they imagined it, and also how, again, they used this venue, that of translating or pseudo-translating Sanskrit erotic poetry, as liberating, because they could talk about feelings or talk about or describe sexual encounters that otherwise perhaps they wouldn't have been able to describe if they had signed these poems as their own, as their own creation. So this is also something that really, that I still find very thought-provoking and something I'm still coming to terms with, still trying to unpack.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing these examples with us and your findings more generally, because I think it really widens our perspective of the field as well. So thank you. Yes, and I think that exploring this area of research, this Sanskrit erotic poetry and also its reception, really could potentially help us widen or reimagine the discipline of classics or the canon of classics in the future. And I just wanted to have your thoughts on this. Wanted to ask you if you also think that this could have an impact on how we see classics.
Absolutely. I think that I'm thinking now of classics as of the classical canon, really as a process. So I'm really trying to look at how the canon of classical works is not something that it's not a given. It's not something that comes from above, that has somehow crystallized, solidified at a specific moment in time, and it has remained immutable, unchangeable. No, I'm really interested in classics as a process, as a negotiation, as a dialogue, which also entails some tensions and some misunderstandings, and also this whole notion of comparison and the comparative angle and comparative attitudes. This is also problematic, because I don't want to give you the impression that I am uncritically looking at the comparative attitude that these Orientalists and philologists had. I mean, their comparative attitude was and still is deeply problematic, just as our comparative attitude can be, because comparison can entail a hierarchy. It can entail hegemony. So one literary culture that is used as the touchstone, and the other literary cultures that are looked at as if they were satellites, as part, not really part of a constellation, but really one literary culture being, let's say, the sun, and the others are just planets around it, gravitating around it. So that is problematic. So also what I'm trying to do is to think at how we can reverse certain attitudes in terms of, again, hierarchies. And again, I'm trying to see how sometimes even these 19th century philologists were gesturing towards a more, I would say, democratic comparative classics intertextual field, how they weren't only translating Sanskrit works into Latin, but also sometimes they attempted to translate, say, Greek poetry into Sanskrit. And this might seem just, you know, like an empty intellectual exercise, just a way, you know, to show off. But I think it has a significance if we try to give to this kind of exercise the right significance. And if we try also to decenter, because ultimately, I think that what we're trying, you and I, and perhaps to an extent also some, at least, of these Orientalists, I believe, trying to decenter ourselves, our perspectives, and the field of classics as a whole, and try to look, perhaps even to go back to the Greco-Roman materials, looking at them from a Sanskritic angle and through a Sanskritic lens. And that, I think, would be very, very productive. So reversing, really, the attitude and the kind of implicit or explicit hierarchy.
Right, yes, thank you. Maddalena, I really have to thank you for the enormous insight that you gave us into this research area.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you also to everyone for listening to this episode of Ancient World, New Voices. You can drop your comments on the feedback form of the podcast's webpage, and we look forward to welcoming you back for the next episode. You can find more information about this podcast's guest speakers, hosts, and materials on the UCL Department of Greek and Latin website, which you can find in the description below.